come for me. Bali high, Bali high, Bali high. Someday you'll see me floating in the sunshine, my head sticking out from a low flying cloud. Sunshine, sweet and clear as can be. Come to me, here am I. Come to me. Come to me, come to me, Bali high, Bali high, Bali
Today is Monday, April 14th, 2011. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
I'm Claire Eagle, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Good evening, it's 5:05 and time for a full hour of independent news. Today, we'll be bringing you federal election news and a special news segment from News 101 reporter Martin Lemlin.
As well, we'll be talking to Colleen Kimmett from the online magazine Tai.ca about the new leader of the BC NDP, Adrian Dix, and about the new People's Food Policy, which discusses citizens' vision for a food-secure Canada. Adam Ganoush will be discussing an upcoming play at the Waldorf this weekend.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Syria today, tens of thousands of mourners turned out for funerals after some 25 protesters were killed Sunday in homes. Witnesses report that security forces clad in civilian clothes opened fire on a group of demonstrators. A video obtained by Al Jazeera shows some people lugging a victim amid the gunfire. WikiLeaks has released documents that reveal for the past 5 years, the U.S. has covertly financially supported the Syrian opposition, including funding an anti-government satellite TV channel. And an occasional contributor to FSRN, journalist Khalid Sid Mohand, was arrested more than a week ago in Syria. Rafael Kraft has more.
The 40-year-old independent journalist disappeared Saturday, April 9th, when he missed his daily security call to a colleague based in Beirut. Khalid Sid Mohand is a regular contributor to French public radio's France Culture and an occasional correspondent for Le Monde newspaper and Free Speech Radio News. One of his relatives, Fatima Sissani, says they don't know where he is being held.
At this moment, we don't have much news about him. We know that both French and Algerian authorities are rallying to free him, but the Syrians still haven't acknowledged his arrest. We learned of his detention through French and Algerian diplomats, and also because some Syrian NGOs have testimonies from people who have been released who say they saw Khalid.
According to Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, threats and attacks on journalists in Syria have increased during the current unrest, and many Syrian journalists and bloggers have been arrested. Rafael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
In Libya, the humanitarian crisis continues to deepen. Food and medicines are running out in Misurata, where electricity and water are only intermittently available. Britain is chartering ships to ferry migrants from the region. The EU is readying a force of 1,000 troops for boots-on-the-ground security for relief efforts. The armed troops will not be authorized for combat, but will be able to use force to protect aid workers and victims. Women across Yemen were among hundreds of thousands of demonstrators out yesterday after the nation's president said last week that females who participate in protest are acting against Islam. Troops fired tear gas and live ammunition. Dozens were wounded. At least 10 people died today in Nigeria's post-election riots after early results indicate the incumbent president is set to win. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
A curfew has been imposed in Kaduna, one of the states most affected by the violence. Buildings, including churches, have been burned down. Soldiers are patrolling the streets to maintain law and order. The post-electoral violence in Kaduna and other states in the north highlights the power struggle between the Christian South and the Muslim North of Africa's most populous country. Most of those involved in the fighting are believed to be supporters of the main opposition candidate, Muhammadu Buhari, a northern Muslim. His supporters are unhappy that it appears he has lost the presidential contest to incumbent Goodluck Jonathan, a Christian from the South. Religious differences are at the heart of conflicts that have claimed more than 14,000 lives since Nigeria returned to civil rule 12 years ago. Nigeria is Africa's top oil producer. Political crisis in the West African nation can affect its oil exports, which accounts for more than 90% of its export earnings. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The U.S. Supreme Court today refused to hear an appeal from 5 Uyghurs who remain detained at Guantanamo Bay. According to a U.S. district judge, the men were never so-called enemy combatants. They were among 22 men who escaped fighting in Afghanistan in 2002, were arrested in Pakistan, handed over to the U.S. for a bounty, and transferred to Gitmo. In 2008, a district court ordered they be released into the United States, but the order was appealed. All but the remaining five have been resettled in other countries. Those still in detention have refused two offers for resettlement. And in Benton Harbor, Michigan today, the only thing that duly elected city officials can do is call a meeting to order, approve the minutes, and adjourn. That's because under a recently enacted law, the governor has installed an emergency manager to take over the town. Benton Harbor is in deep fiscal trouble. Nearly half of the people who live there do so in poverty. The town's emergency manager is granted total authority over all municipal offices. And according to Forbes, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is crafting a bill that would grant him similar powers to take over towns in financial distress, including canceling union contracts and sidestepping school boards. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
And thanks, as always, to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. In local news, a revised Vancouver City bylaw will allow the Chinese philosophical group, the Falun Gong, to keep the small hut structure they erected as part of a vigil outside the Chinese Consulate General in the city. The vigil was first erected in 2001 to protest persecution by the Chinese government. In 2006, Mayor Sullivan ordered that the structure must be taken down because it violated street and traffic bylaws. This issue went all the way to the BC Supreme Court, where they sustained the mayor's decision. But this decision was then overturned by the BC Court of Appeals, by the BC Court of Appeals in 2010, which claimed that the city's bylaws was unconstitutional. At this point, Vancouver was ordered to draft new bylaws within 6 months. In what has been hailed as a victory for free speech activists, the bylaw entitled Political Expression on Structures on Streets, released last week, dictated that structures can be erected on public property only if they meet certain size requirements and are taken down every 12 hours. These new restrictions will require the Falun Gong hut to be taken down to its current size. It'll require it to be taken down on its current size and almost halved. According to the Falun Gong's lawyer, Clive Astley, this restriction may provoke the group to sue the city for infringing on the constitutional rights to protest.
In provincial news, Adrian Dix has been elected the new leader of the provincial New Democratic Party in an election called after party infighting led to the forced resignation of Carol James in December of last year. The third ballot victory allowed him to barely edge out ahead of his more centralist rival, Mike Farnsworth. Less than 700 votes came between the two candidates. John Horgan was in third place in the first round with 4,844 votes, while marijuana activist Dana Larson received only 531 votes. Dix, who campaigned on increasing taxes to banks to fund more social programs, is considered to be one of the more leftist NDP leaders. The two-term MLA for Vancouver Kingsway will now be charged with uniting the deeply fractured party and leading them into an election against the Christy Clark Liberals in the near future. The next mandatory due date for a provincial election will not be until 2013, but Premier Clark has indicated that she may call one earlier than that.
In election news, following this past week's English and French language debates, the Conservatives still hold on to a solid lead over their rivals. The news story has been the rise of the New Democrats. Multiple polls have shown that Jack Layton's approval rating has steadily been rising, while Ignatieff has been sliding downwards. Some interpret this as evidence that Canadians are beginning to see Layton as a viable leadership option for the country. In the Nanos research poll, Layton scored particularly high in the trust category. At one point, his overall score was 18 points over that of Michael Ignatieff. The same poll showed that healthcare has become a more important issue amongst voters than jobs or the economy, an issue which has worked to the advantage of both the Liberals and NDP. Although Jack Layton has reached a higher approval rating than Ignatieff, the NDP still trails the Liberals amongst decided voters. If the economy as an issue gains steam, it might work well for Harper and the Conservatives going into the May 2nd election.
And in campus news, the UBC Botanical Garden and Center for Plant Research, which includes the Natobi Memorial Garden, have joined the Faculty of Science. Previously housed in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, this transfer of attractions creates a cluster of attractions within the Faculty of Science that includes the Beattie Biodiversity Museum and the Pacific Museum of the Earth. Says Dean of Science Simon Peacock, quote, The Botanical Garden focuses on living plant biodiversity, which directly complements the biodiversity collections housed in the Beatty Biodiversity Museum, particularly in the herbarium collection. Through these venues, we have an unparalleled opportunity to share our passion for and communicate the importance of biodiversity within the broader community. The transfer also presents us with a number of exciting opportunities to advance our biodiversity education and research programs. End quote. So we're going to take a quick break now, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here on 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
What do you think the internet should be? Fast? Open? Reliable? A network that is diverse, free, and allows an equal exchange of ideas? This point of view is often challenged by monopolies in the media, as well as by decisions made on issues such as internet openness and usage-based billing. Without question, these decisions have an immense impact on consumers, socially and economically. Let's admit it, the internet has become an essential part of our lives. That's where we come in. OpenMedia.ca is here to ensure that the decisions regarding the internet are fair and citizen-friendly. OpenMedia.ca is a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We advocate for a media communication system that adheres to the principles of access, choice, diversity, innovation, and openness. Our organization provides resources for volunteer organizers, collaboration tools, and leadership development. We engage, we educate, we empower. For more information, visit openmedia.ca, saveournet.ca, or follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. So it's now time for your weekly arts report with Adam Yanush.
At the end of the Fringe Festival last fall, there is an award ceremony. Marissa Smith walked away with not one, but two of those awards. In fact, two rubber chickens, which is the trophy that they give out. She won the Cultivating the Fringe Award for her play Wicked Shorts. That means the Cult will host another run of that play, their season opener, no less, coming up this fall. Marissa also picked up the Joanna Murata Award for Mentorship. But amidst all that, she's also remounting a play called Tape at the Waldorf. That was out in 2009. It got rave reviews at that year's Fringe. It was completely sold out and held over. The Georgia Strait called it fantastically authentic. The Courier called it one of the best shows of the year, and more and more and more and more. So obviously a lot to talk about with Marissa, and we started with a little bit about Wicked Shorts.
Well, originally it was a site-specific show at Wicked Cafe, and we commissioned we put out a call for submissions for short plays, two-handers to be done, and we chose four of them, and that was what made up Wicked Shorts at the Wicked Cafe for The Fringe, and it was a site-specific BYOV thing. Coming up at the Kulch, we're going to restage the show in their studio. So we're going to transform their culture lab into a culture cafe.
No way.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of recreate that BYOV feel.
Yeah, yeah. It should be really interesting because I'm going to add a lot of lighting to kind of create atmosphere. In that space, and we're gonna
more than you could in a cafe, maybe. Right?
Yeah, 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 totally. And there's a bit more room, so the actors can kind of enter and exit from in and around the audience, and there'll be tables and chairs, so you'll feel like you're in this sort of cafe cabaret type setting. So
we'll be serving cocktails.
I hope so. Definitely. They're trying to get licensing for inside the space, but if not, you can always bring your drink from the bar.
I meant that as a joke, but
no, seriously, yeah, you can have a drink while you're watching the show.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that'll be coming up later, but for now, you are busy gearing up for another show, and this is Tape, which is another remount.
Yes.
Tell us about this one.
This is happening at the Waldorf Hotel, and we originally staged it in 2009 at The Fringe, and we sold out our run and held over and sold out the holdover, and it was just a fantastic experience. It's a wonderful script by Stephen Belber.
And what do you think resonated really with audiences? Like, this was done in a hotel room at the Waldorf, and will be again, although in a different room this time, a few changes here and there. What do you think it was about this show that really captured audiences' attention?
Well, probably the site-specific nature of it. Like, it's an 18-person audience. You all go into this hotel room, and for 1 hour, it all happens in real time. There's no blackouts or transitions. It's just everything's happening right in front of you. So you're just part of it, and there's these three characters that are kind of battling back and forth about an issue that happened in the past. You don't really know who's wrong and who's right and what the real reality of the situation is. But there's some pretty funny moments, some business in the bathroom and then out the window, and all sorts of fun stuff that you can have in site-specific theater. So I think that's one of the main attractions.
Great. And we didn't talk about the other award that you won, the Joanna Murata Award, is all about mentorship. And have you been able to sort of apply some of those skills? I mean, it's ongoing, right? So you're obviously still learning, but have you noticed that this version of Tape has benefited from that?
I think so. I mean, I'll be performing and producing in this one. A lot of my mentorship so far has been for directing and producing, but it's still, I mean, you can always learn. I mean, I'm always learning from everybody that I encounter. So, but a lot of the learning that's happened this year has been focused on directing, which is pretty exciting because I'm sort of an emerging director myself. And I just recently got to assistant direct with Ron Jenkins in the Kulch premiere of 1984.
The adaptation, yeah.
Yeah, and it was such a fantastic experience. And I think I'm going to be able to apply some of that stuff that I learned there to Wicked Shorts with, you know, when it comes to tech, lighting, and transitions. Because Ron Jenkins is just a magician when it comes to incorporating design elements. And
that's inspiring, isn't it? Just the scale, the ambition of using all these technological, you know, all these ideas, all these possibilities, and incorporating them into theater, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, you mentioned blackouts there, that the show is very sort of immediate.
Yes.
It's very, you know, you're there in the hotel room 18, with 18 friends or strangers.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, where do you think that style of theater, that approach is better than others where you do use blackouts? Like, I'm thinking of the blackout issue in particular, because a friend of mine, some actors, they hate them. Like, I hate blackouts. It ruins everything.
Well, sometimes it can stop the arc
momentum.
Of the story, the momentum.
Okay.
And also, I think actually Ron said this to me during rehearsals, is that blackouts can be very powerful if you wait for the right moment for them. If there's a really good reason other than, you know, just trying to get to the next scene. Because you can use them for you know, for tension building, or you know, if there's sound happening in that blackout that's telling the story. So sometimes they're good, but when they're misused or just used for no particular reason, it's sort of, it gets tiresome.
Hmm.
But that's one of the fun things about this show is that the action never stops.
Right.
You're always in it, and you're just, you know, you're taking on this little 1 hour journey of excitement.
And as an actor, isn't it tougher when the audience is like right there and you can see them, their eyeballs?
It's really, it gets a bit nerve wracking, but it's exciting for us too, you know, because it really keeps us on our toes.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
We cannot. There's no.
There's no escape.
Yeah, there's no escape. They can tell exactly what you're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, even when you're in between the lines, there's no room for BS, so to speak.
You have to be really kind of honest and real, right? There's no room for BS, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
And that's Marissa Smith talking about. Talking about tape and the immediacy of the performance, which I love. I love, I love, I love seeing and being in shows where the audience is right there in front of you. I think it does bring an excellent feeling of immediacy, and it forces you to be a better actor. It makes you work harder, I think, and forces you to give a better performance. So you can be one of those lucky 18 people sitting there, right there in that hotel room at the Waldorf. For the tickets are $15 for that. It's cash only at the door. And that's happening from April 20th until the 24th. Two shows, 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. Three shows on the weekend, matinees at 3 p.m. And Marissa really wanted me to stress that it is so important to get tickets early because there are only 18 seats, only 18, so they will go fast. And you can reserve tickets in advance by calling 604-671-9776.
Thank you for that, Adam. And now we go to Martin Lemon, who conducted an interview with Dr. Alexandra Morton earlier this week.
Dr. Alexandra Morton is campaigning door-to-door to all the candidates throughout the Lower Mainland to see, in fact, where they stand on the subject of salmon farming and feedlotting in particular. Doctor, how has it been going so far?
Yes, well, we just got here yesterday, and it was mostly the inquiry, so we're full bore on that today. We've been to Andrew Saxton, Conservative for North Vancouver, and we'll be meeting also, hopefully, with the Liberal Party and definitely with the Greens and the NDP as well.
So far, how do you feel the candidates have responded to the feedlotting industry in BC?
Well, it's very interesting. Now, we are early in this, but not one candidate has come out in support of the salmon feedlot industry. We had a meeting in Campbell River the day before yesterday, right across the street from the Conservative office, John Duncan's office. He has, in the past, been very strongly supporting salmon farming, but it was a no-show. And we went to his office and left the questions. And it's basically, you know, will you stand for us, the Canadian public, and our salmon, and remove these feedlots from the migration routes?
Why is it that you've decided to become involved in the fight against salmon feedlots?
The reason I feel so strongly about this is I'm a biologist. I lived in a tiny little community of Echo Bay for 26 years. You know, no electricity there, no roads. I was studying the killer whales, and when the industry arrived, I thought it was a great idea. And gradually, we have felt the full pressure of the weight of this industry. It's just squashed the life out of my community. There's no school. There's only 8 people left. The whales I was studying have vanished. The salmon are in decline. We have toxic algae blooms. We have Atlantic salmon in our rivers. We have enormous mountains of their manure on the bottom, on the seafloor, where there used to be prawns and other species. And it's very interesting, you know, when you're in this situation. I have avoided every environmental issue in my life, but this one came into my home and began to wreck it while they were telling us this was good for us. And that's where I really take exception. If the industry came in and the government told us, okay, there are serious issues with this industry, there's been wild salmon collapses wherever it goes, but we think this is good for you and here's why, and you decide if you want it or not. That would have been honest. But instead, it's been, this is good for you, it's sustainable, it's going to feed the world. No, it's no on all of those. It's farming salmon, they have to catch fish and grind them up into pellets and then move them all the way from Chile to here and throw those fish basically back into the water, starving one ocean, polluting this one. And in the end, they're selling less fish than they had originally when they caught the bait fish for food. The impact of the industry is well researched. There's papers from every country that has it. There's viruses following the industry around. The Norwegian government no longer thinks it's sustainable. And the government here has been so pro-salmon farming that they refuse to actually look at the details of it. And so about 10 years ago, I dropped my whale research and began to study the impact of this industry through sea lice and escaped fish and what's happening on the bottom. And Simon Fraser University gave me an honorary doctorate for this work, but the government refuses to acknowledge it. And they just say, oh, we need more research, while the industry remains in the water getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's 92% Norwegian-owned. It's owned by shareholders. There's only 1,000 employees in British Columbia directly employed by it. They're low-paying jobs. We could definitely have an aquaculture industry in British Columbia that is Canadian, would take up those jobs, and would truly make food by farming lower on the food chain. And that's the direction this has to go.
So feedlotting itself is a fairly new practice then?
It is fairly new. It's been in British Columbia for 20 years, slowly ramping up. But aquaculture itself is, you know, 10,000 years old. And in Asia, they would raise fish in these pools, and then they would raise the rice that grew very well on the manure from the fish, and they have lots of products there. This raising a carnivore is one of these corporate schemes that is really damaging our planet. And if the people just said no, the companies would do something else. The jobs could be, like I said, in land-based aquaculture. I think there'd be a huge industry in growing algaes, the different seaweeds that people both need for health and also, you know, we love in our sushi and many other foods that are, you know, very low on the food chain, and then you can feed this to other animals if you don't want to eat it yourself, and, you know, start at the bottom with sunlight and water. So it's just one of those, it's one of those things that is going to remain a problem until the people stand up, and then it'll get fixed, and people look back on this chapter and go, you know, what were we thinking?
There must be assets to feedlotting. The whole point is to create food for people, right?
Oh, yeah. So, but this industry is not about feeding people, because otherwise you would eat the anchovies they're catching in Chile to feed to these Atlantic fish. If you want to feed people, you need to grow a fish that eats plants and then take the waste from those fish and produce another crop. Like, there's a guy in Quebec that I use as an example a lot. He's in an industry newspaper, Northern Aquaculture. He grows 640 pounds of trout a week and 18,000 heads of romaine lettuce. And the lettuce grows on the fish waste, and the water for the fish is getting cleaned by being used by the lettuce. And that's an ecosystem model. That's how everything on Earth works. It's all in a circle. And this guy's not doing it because he's an environmentalist. He's doing it because he's making money. There's people in British Columbia that have come to me and asked me to support their various operations, Canadians. They all want to use the manure from the fish rather than allowing it to produce these. They produce these mountains of white bacteria that only can grow in a high sulfur rich environment. And these things are gassing off with methane. I just have a study starting up on that, and I have researchers out that have been filming, and I have been horrified by looking at it, even though conceptually I knew that must be what was going on. It's so wasteful, because that manure actually is also a product that can grow things. So the Norwegians are using our coast as a dump site, and if they were telling the public the truth of the situation, I would just leave and go someplace else. But They're telling us things that are not true. And it's in my home, you know, and that's, for me, that's my fuel source. Is it's, I just want to go back to the wilderness and, you know, go back to studying the whales and the dolphins and the salmon. But I really can't go back there now and just watch it all die.
So what is the government's justification for the feedlots? Are we condoning them?
They have condoned them, that's right. And they looked at this coast and said, hey, this is perfect. And they've just moved right in. And it's 92% Norwegian. You cannot reason with them. They have been so protected by government. They don't need to consult with the First Nations in my area. The First Nations in my area are completely against this. And my neighbors who had fisheries for rockfish and prawns and other species were completely displaced. They just plopped down the farms right over top of their fishing grounds. I mean, really, they've just been bullied. And I don't know why our governments are so seduced by them, but they need to wake up and decide who they're working for here.
And Fisheries and Oceans Canada, DFO, what are their role in this this process, and specifically the Cohen inquiry?
Basically, our tax dollars are going to DFO to be a public relations firm for these companies. And here we thought we were paying DFO to protect our wild fish. So that's really got to get straightened out. And the Cohen inquiry is an incredibly powerful process. Justice Cohen is the first man in the world to actually get the disease records out of the hands of this industry and into the hands of people like myself who are participants of the inquiry. And the aquaculture part of the hearing will be in the middle of August, and so people should really stand by for that. And we're going to have a march into Victoria from Sydney, 25 kilometers, on election day. And we're going to put a public presence on there and just be a salmon school, a school of wild salmon people standing up for our fish. Because it really, it's not just salmon that's this issue. We're losing democracy. We're losing access to local resources.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Morton. We appreciate it. And good luck with your campaign.
And thank you so much for calling me.
If you would like to know more about Dr. Alexandra Morton and her campaign to help prevent and stop salmon feedlots in British Columbia, you can visit votesalmon.ca.
And thank you to Martin for that report. And we're now actually going to talk to Colleen Kimmett from the online magazine, thetai.ca. So, Colleen, it's great to have you on today.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So, first of all, I think actually Iqbal's going to chat with you a little bit just about the NDP leadership race. And tell us a bit. I know Adrian Dix just won. And what does that mean for the party?
Well, from what I've heard on radio commentary and in papers today, the Liberals seem to be pretty happy about that. So perhaps that means they think he is an easy person for Christy Clark to compete with. Certainly, Christy Clark, publicly congratulated him and said that it's a clear choice. So I think basically it means that Dix is representing definitely more of a left of center position than perhaps another NDP candidate, leadership candidate would have.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that too, that Dix kind of represents a move to the left even for the NDP. And it's interesting to note that how close the race was. I believe it was less than 700 votes between him and Farnsworth.
Yeah, that's right. It was, I just did the math, actually, 677 mm-hmm. votes over Farnworth. And actually, I was talking with some people on the weekend, and there's three or four of us, and we all thought that Farnworth would come out mm-hmm. victorious, but he didn't. Dix did. So it'll be interesting to see how I think Dix mobilizes the environmental community mm-hmm. in BC, because I really do think that Carol James alienated some of that community in the last election when she came out so hard against the carbon tax.
Mm-hmm. I know it was kind of the popular sentiment around here that it would be Farnsworth, and a few environmental groups even endorsed him, just because Adrian Dix has seemed like such a polarizing figure in the party,
mm-hmm.
and especially in a time when party unity is so important, with everything with Carol James being ousted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is just what the party needs. Maybe he can, you know, energize it and bring it together again.
Hopefully, well, we'll see how a potential future election pans out against this new Christie Clark BC Liberals.
Indeed.
And then, okay, Colleen, so I know you wrote an article about this People's Food Policy Project, which just came out, and what their new food policy that was just released said. And so can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. The People's Food Policy Project is an umbrella group that represents different food security advocates and organizations across the country. And for the past 2 years, it's been holding consultations to develop this People's Food Policy, which it released today. It's pretty sweeping. It addresses everything, recommending a higher minimum wage, a living wage across the country, so people don't have to choose between food and rent. It looks at sustainable fisheries as well as taking into consideration indigenous food and land rights. So it's much, much more than just agriculture. It's about all aspects of food, social, economic, political, and cultural.
And I know the fact that it included the fisheries as well as indigenous food and land rights is, I guess, individual and unique for something that deals with agriculture that way. What sort of recommendations did the policy make in these areas?
It calls for basically more of a fisheries that is more controlled at a community level. And I mentioned the poverty reduction plan and an effective national housing program. I would say the overarching idea is to move away from commodity-based, export-focused agriculture and towards community-based, sustainability-focused agriculture. So the saying is feed the family and sell the leftovers, which, I mean, it's as a federal policy on agriculture really is mostly focused on Canada's export markets. So I don't know if there'll be much uptake at a federal level, but I think this is certainly a good blueprint and a good starting point for provincial and municipal governments. And it's a good place to start to begin to have that national discussion on food and food policy.
Right, and I guess because it is so sweeping and not just agriculture related, do you see it having maybe a broader social change, even if it doesn't necessarily have that federal change that we want to see, but do you think it'll have that impact on a more grassroots level?
Yeah, I think it will. I think it will because food is now a federal political issue, and so I think that hopefully grassroots groups that have been working on food security will now have the ear of federal and provincial decision makers and policy makers. I think this lends some credibility to the movement, and it's kind of like the food movement has arrived in Canada now.
So what's next, do you think, for this group? I guess I'm not too sure about too much background on the food policy project itself, but do you think they're going to keep releasing policies like this, or do you think they're going to move into different movements from now?
Yeah, well, they've indicated that this is a living document that they want to change and shape as they go. And I think organizations like this will only become stronger.
Well, great. Thanks so much, Colleen. Good to have you on, as always.
You're welcome. Nice talking to you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And that was Colleen Kimmett from the Tie.ca. And now we go to Martin Lemon with our weekly weather forecast.
Thank you, Iqbal. Your weekly weather forecast for the greater Vancouver area is looking pretty decent. You're going to have, we're sitting at 8 degrees right now with 8 degrees steady overnight. 71% humidity, not very much wind. Tomorrow morning it's going to be down to 5 degrees and 10 degrees later in the afternoon. And, here we go. It's going to be maintaining, get steadily warmer throughout the week. 10 degrees on Wednesday, 12 Thursday, 13 Friday, into 14 degrees. Sunshine throughout the week, a little bit of rain on Wednesday, but it's going to be pretty good.
That is CITR weather.
Great. Thanks, Martin. That sounds great. Always nice to have some sunshine in Vancouver. So we're going to take a quick break right now, but do stay with us. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Youth for Climate Justice Now are pleased to announce a historic Earth Day parade beginning at 11 a.m. on Friday, April 22nd. The parade will start at the intersection of Commercial and Broadway and culminate in a festival at the Oval Field at Britannia Secondary School at William and Woodland. The festival will feature guest speakers, poetry, and music, including an appearance from East Van favorites Maria in the Shower. This Earth Day, show your love for the planet. Join the parade. It all starts at 11 a.m. at Commercial and Broadway. To learn more, check out earthdayparade.ca.
The most effective development resource for emerging countries and around the world is money being sent home by immigrant families and migrant workers. Banks and financial transfer organizations are charging more than 20% of the total transfer or remittance in so-called costs and fees. The G8, including Canada, has called for a 5% cap on all of these predatory charges by 2014, but little progress has been made. More than 50,000 family members of Acorn Canada and Acorn International in seven other countries around the world are calling for financial institutions to answer this call and lower their charges. We are also asking that the federal and provincial governments shoulder their responsibilities and finally regulate these companies so that these predatory practices end immediately. Join us. Ask the hard questions. Demand the right answers. Stop predatory costs for new Canadians supporting their families and communities in former countries. For more information, please contact Toronto Acorn at 1-416-469-9233, Ottawa Acorn at 613-744-7228, BC Acorn at 604-522-8707. Thank you.
And welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. So we're now going to go to an interview that our reporter Martin Lemlin did with the 22-year-old candidate for the NDP in the Caribou Prince George riding, who's actually a forestry student here at UBC.
An interesting thing is happening in the Prince George Caribou riding in British Columbia this election season. Young people are getting involved. Not just in exercising their democratic right, but actually flexing their democratic muscles and running for office. 22-year-old Jonathan Van Barneveld is a forest ecology and management student at the University of British Columbia. He's also the new Democratic Party candidate in the Caribou region, and CITR is happy to present this exclusive interview with John. Well, as a student, what inspired you to run for office? It would have to be something you seek out, right?
Yeah, I've always been involved in politics. I have about 7 years of political experience behind me. I worked for Nathan Cullen, a member of parliament in Skeena-Bulkley Valley, for most of his campaign. And I was involved in lots of the HST referendums around the province, especially up here in the north. You know, I'm involved in local riding associations and all that. So, I this is the first time that I put my name forward as a candidate. But, politics isn't really new to me. And I think the forestry industry has always needed active people in politics to advocate on their behalf.
Well, especially in Prince George, forestry is one of the major industries there, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. It's a major employer in the north.
The incumbent conservative, Dick Harris, he hasn't really been dethroned in about 20 years. What do you feel is the political atmosphere in the Caribou right now?
Well, I think the Caribou has always been, the main contest has always been between New Democrats and Conservatives. Dick Harris, he's been around for 17, 18 years. And I think that's not too bad of a stretch for us as New Democrats to think about overruling. We've held this riding in the past, and I think it's definitely within grasp again. Lots of the people around the riding are saying that they're tired of what's happening here. They're tired of the representation that they've had. And they're ready for change.
And what do you feel are the major concerns in the area? I know there's high unemployment and low post-secondary education, but obviously the lumber industry has to take a priority, so to speak.
Well, yeah, the major recession around the world has been in the last 2 years, but the northern British Columbia has been economically depressed for the best portion of the last 15 years. You know, so we know what it's like to live under these conditions, and you know, the forestry industry has been hit first and foremost by the mountain pine beetle. And international markets, we've seen a lack of representation on the softwood lumber agreement. People are worried about keeping their jobs, and I think that's a real major issue going forward in this election.
And how do you think your studies in forestry, ecology, and management can help you in your writing?
Well, I think out of all the candidates running in this election, I'm the best suited to represent forestry and the industry. You know, Dick Harris, he really hasn't been exposed to much of the industry, and I feel that I'm the best qualified to grapple with the inherent and systemic issues that are plaguing our industry at the moment.
Now, you aren't the only student running in Prince George. Do you think that there's any relevance to the fact that about half the candidates are under 25 and students?
Yeah, it's great, actually. We have, you know, we have myself, another UMBC student who's running for the Rhino Party, and a UBC student who's running for the Liberals. So, you know, we have a, when people come to the debate, you know, a good portion of them are going to be young, and I think that's a great thing to consider. You know, we have a new wave of people who are being interested in politics. They're fed up with the current representation, and I think they really want change. So it's great to see that younger people, you know, not the typically senior folk of our current parliament, are putting their names forward and starting to get involved. And I think that can benefit people of any age.
So it has helped you reach out to young voters then?
Oh, yes. We've had a huge wave of enthusiasm from people here, especially at UMBC. You know, they're in my riding, and they, lots of them support me very, very enthusiastically. I think that, you know, we've had a huge energy of volunteers come out, and I think that it's going to be a great asset to us in this campaign.
So in Prince George, you guys have had as much trouble as the rest of the country attracting young voters then?
Yeah, it's a struggle. You know, all across the country, we've had an increase in apathy towards politics and a decrease in voter turnout, and it's just plaguing our system. So I think you know, the younger we can get people involved in politics, the longer they're going to stay in the system.
You think Prince George is becoming sort of a launching ground for young politicians?
Well, you know, ever since the university was built here in Prince George, it has done wonders for the community and for the region. We've had a number of students run for politics in the past, including a currently sitting MP, which is a graduate from UMBC. I think it is a launching point. You know, it's definitely benefited the community, and I think that UMBC's influence is only going to increase.
As far as scheduling goes, how has juggling school and the election been for you? Has it been exhausting?
No, not at all. In fact, I've had an enjoyable time doing it. You know, it's I've had some finals and stuff, but I think that you know, this campaign is really what matters. Is in addition to my education, and I think that to show that a candidate can do such things means that you know, they're dedicated, they're hard workers, and I think they're the best suited to represent this riding.
Is there anything else you'd like to touch on, John, before we let you go?
No, that's fine. It's you know, there's a whole range of issues up here in Cariboo, Prince George, that might not be noticed around the riding. You know, most of our population lives in the south, and I think northern representation really needs to start taking place on a larger scale.
Thank you very much for joining us, and good luck in your riding.
Yeah, no problem.
Jonathan Van Barneveld is a forestry, ecology, and management student at UNBC, and he's running for the NDP in the Cariboo, Prince George region of British Columbia. For more information, you can go to ndp.ca. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And thank you, Martin, for that report. And now we're going to go to FSRN for a story on thousands of young people who rallied in Washington in support of clean energy.
Thousands of demonstrators, mostly young people, took to the streets of Washington today to show their support for a clean energy economy. The rallies and protests come at the close of the Power Shift Youth Climate Conference that aims to train and organize youth to work in clean energy projects back in their communities. Michael Lawson reports.
A diverse sea of faces, chanting, drums, and youthful excitement flow through central Washington, D.C. Monday.
Protesters held large signs representing members of Congress who take money from large oil interests. First Nations member Adam Thomas came from northern British Columbia, Canada.
I'm here talking about Enbridge, how they propose to put a pipeline through our territories and communities, and I want to spread the awareness of that.
After gathering at the White House, over 3,000 demonstrators marched to the U.S. Chamber and BP's Washington, D.C. offices. Courtney Hyde is co-director of the Energy Action Coalition.
We're going after some of the power within D.C., so asking the president to stand with us against big polluters, going to the Hill, asking Congress as well to shift subsidies and stand with us, and then going after the corporate polluters themselves, BP, Chamber of Commerce.
Hyde's organization sponsored the three-day conference, which included Al Gore, EPA Chief Lisa Jackson, and Green Jobs activist Van Jones as keynote speakers. In addition to rallying and training, nearly 10,000 attendees also lobby on Capitol Hill for changes to promote climate justice. According to Hyde, their current focus is protection of the Clean Air Act.
We do have a lot of support out there, mostly Democrats, but we're talking to everybody about it because to us this isn't... It's not a Democrat or Republican idea to want clean air.
Part of the conference sought to give a voice to youth from what is called the front lines of climate change and pollution, those in communities with incinerators and coal plants. Ronald Collins is a youth leader with the Bus Riders Union in Los Angeles that encourages greater mass transit use.
This isn't a one-time thing, you know. Like, yeah, we came here for Power Shift and, you know, it's a weekend, but really we take this fight back into our local communities and it's something that we do every single day of our lives, right? And, you know, and really I think it's so important for you to just get out and get involved. You know, find a local organization, get involved, and if you don't have a local organization, create a local organization.
Outside of BP's offices, the crowd chanted for executives to come out as attendees spoke about their experiences working in Louisiana following the Gulf oil spill. One man held up a jar of sand and oil he says was collected from the Gulf Coast 2 weeks ago. The group Common Cause helped to sponsor Power Shift and seeks to diminish corporate influence in politics. Bob Edgar is president of Common Cause.
I believe that what you're doing today is starting a movement. Environmentalists, healthcare advocates, peace advocates, justice advocates, international relations folks, you can't run two wars without paying for them, and you can't balance a budget on the back of poor people.
Edgar helped deliver a bill for $9.9 billion to BP from American taxpayers for cleanup of the BP oil spill, which started following the deadly April 20th, 2010 explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
And that's our program for April 14th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share a comment, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101.
Thanks, Iqbal. I'm Claire Eagle, and Iqbal, I just realized we've been saying it's April 14th all along, but it's actually the 18th, so sorry about that for any of our listeners who are confused about the date. And today's show is produced by Iqbal Ahmed, and from the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.